Hello, I'm Dr. Michelle Buckley from Iowa State University's College of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks so much for joining us on Baws and Bleats, sponsored by the American Association of Small Ruminant Practitioners. Just a quick note before we get started, this work is also supported by the USDA National Institute of Food and Agriculture Agricultural and Food Research Initiative Competitive Program Antimicrobial Resistance Grant Number 2020-04197, which funds my research on improving antibiotic stewardship in dairy goats to assure food safety and milk quality. As always, if you have any questions about any of our episodes, please email them to dairygoatextension@iastate.edu. I hope you enjoy today's show. Thanks for joining us today on Season 1 of Baws and Bleats, the American Association of Small Ruminant Practitioners podcast. This season, we're focusing on improving milk quality and food safety in dairy goats. Today, we have Dr. Virginia Fate from Texas A&M University and Dr. Paul Plummer from Iowa State University, and we'll be discussing antimicrobial resistance in dairy goat production. Thanks for joining us today, everyone. Let's start with some introductions. Dr. Fate, you were our guest on the previous episode about how to use drugs appropriately in dairy goats, so welcome back. For the listeners that missed that episode, could you give us a little refresher on your background as a veterinarian and working with antimicrobial resistance?
Sure. Hi, Michelle. My name is Virginia Fate, and I am a veterinary clinical pharmacologist at Texas A&M University. I deal with lots of issues related to drugs in animals. Particularly, I have an interest in drugs that are used in food-producing animals and specifically antibiotics, which is where my interest in antimicrobial resistance comes about. I am a district director for the American Association of Small Ruminant Practitioners, and I am the AASRP's delegate to an ABMA committee that has an important role in antimicrobial resistance and antimicrobial stewardship, the Committee on Antimicrobials.
Fantastic. Well, I'm glad we were able to get you for this show then. Dr. Plummer, welcome. This is your first time on the podcast. Can you give us a little peek into your history with dairy goats as a veterinarian, and then more specifically your work with antimicrobial resistance?
Sure. It's a pleasure to be here, Michelle, in looking forward to our discussion. As you mentioned, my name's Paul Plummer. I currently am a professor at the College of Veterinary Medicine here at Iowa State University with you, and in my role there, I'm both a PhD microbiologist and have an active research lab, as well as also an internal medicine specialist, and teach or participate in most of our small ruminant electives and clinical rotations here at Iowa State University. I actually did grow up milking dairy goats and continue to milk dairy goats to this day. So I was born into a dairy goat family and have bred Toggenbergs for my entire life, and continue to milk goats this morning before I got on the call here. So they are part of my everyday experience, and milk quality and mastitis is part of that as well. So as it relates to antimicrobial resistance, I have the pleasure of serving as the alternate delegate for AASRP to the AVMA Committee on Antimicrobials with Dr. Fate. I also serve as the executive director for the National Institute for Antimicrobial Resistance Research and Education. That is a group of academic and industry folks that's hosted here at Iowa State, but represents a national membership, and we work to help build collaborations to mitigate antimicrobial resistance development.
Perfect. So we're talking to two experts today, folks. So to get the episode started, I just want to talk about what antimicrobial resistance really is and why do we care about it. I know it sounds big and scary to most people, but let's break it down to a definition. And then I also want to talk about whether just because the resistance might develop in an animal, can it be passed to a human? Can it affect human health as well as animals?
Well, I can provide some initial comments on what antimicrobial resistance is. And so kind of in the most simplified form, we consider antimicrobial resistance when a drug, specifically in this case an antibiotic, that used to be effective in killing a bacteria loses its effectiveness in killing that bacteria. And so after that happens, we are unable to control the disease with that particular antibiotic or control the growth of the organism with that particular antibiotic. So it impacts our ability to keep our animals healthy or humans healthy if it's a resistance that impacts humans. In terms of can it be passed from animals to humans, certainly there's examples where we do see that that can occur. There are particular examples, for instance, in not related to small ruminants, but there's been an identification of antimicrobial resistant bacteria moving from puppies to humans and causing disease in humans. There's some other specific examples where bacterial pathogens have the potential to move resistance to humans. But on large, those are very, very small number of documented clear evidence that transmission can occur from animals to humans. Interestingly, we also have probably an equal number of documented cases of resistance moving from humans to animals with particular organisms as well. And so certainly these organisms can move back and forth. When they move, they have the potential to carry the resistance, but that does not mean necessarily that that organism has the capability to cause disease in the other species, nor does it have the, in some cases, it may not even impact its treatment because we might use a different antibiotic in that other species.
Yeah, just a couple of thoughts. One thing I'd like to add to the conversation about resistance are public health concerns for acquired resistance, like Dr. Plummer's talking about, where for a period of time, some kind of bacteria were susceptible to antibiotics, and now they're not susceptible anymore. Now they're resistant. There are some bacteria drug combinations that are where there's what's called intrinsic resistance. Those bacteria have always been resistant. That's not a new phenomenon. And it's important to separate out when you see reports about resistance, that they're actually talking about acquired resistance, where, and what we mean by acquired is those bacterial species have in some way been exposed to and managed to pull into their own cells DNA that leads to the resistance mechanism. And so along those same lines, those genes that cause resistance are theoretically, at least, can be moved from one bacterial species to another, so that perhaps the resistance isn't in a pathogen, a bacterial organism that causes disease in an animal, but the DNA that causes resistance could potentially move into another species of bacteria that would then be transmitted in some way, either ecologically in the environment or to humans. Those are theoretical risks of antibiotic resistance, and they drive some of the decisions at the regulatory level about what antibiotics are potentially should be removed from use in animals or should be carefully monitored in animals or humans for that matter. So the biggest take home from what you've heard so far and what you'll hear for the rest of this podcast is antimicrobial resistance is complicated. It is ecological. There are different kinds of risk factors and pressures that make a difference in how bacteria grow, how they spread their genes, and so on. And so it's a very complicated discussion. So to me, the most important take home is if you think it's easy to understand, you probably don't or aren't quite grasping it, because it is a very complicated, I think about it as ecology and a system that has multiple inputs and outputs and factors and so on, helps understand why we continue to have conversations and continue to have challenges with making good decisions about how do we make this problem better? How do we preserve the effectiveness of antimicrobials in humans and animals?
Gotcha. So it sounds like, not to simplify a very complicated topic, but it sounds like just because a bacteria has DNA in it that we know causes resistance to an antibiotic doesn't mean it's necessarily problematic in the species that we've identified it. And we know a lot of these plausible scenarios of how resistance is transmitted based on our general understanding of microbiology, but the true understanding of statistical frequency and how often this phenomenon occurs is something that's still under evaluation.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I think because so many things about how bacteria work, how they acquire DNA, how antibiotics select for resistant bacterial populations can be so specific to the individual bacterial species, the individual drug, the scenario where the bacteria are normally living, what the infectious disease is, where that animal or that person inhabits, what their habits are, and so on. And so there have been lots of investigations. There's a lot we know about antibiotic resistance, but much of what we know is about very specific combinations of species of animal or human, bacterial species, and drug or a group of drugs. And everything changes when you change the bacteria, because all the bacterial species are different from each other. They have different normal ecological needs and pathways and so on. And so even if we know a lot about, for example, Salmonella, we don't know as much about other species of bacteria. Or we know about Salmonella in one particular setting, but we don't know very much about it in other settings. And so I think there's a lot we know, but the universe of what we don't know is really big because of this is such a complicated system.
And I think that becomes a challenge for us at both a regulatory and policy level discussion because, you know, as I pointed out in my first comments, yes, there are specific examples where we have evidence of direct transfer and an impact, but those are very limited. But it can be, you know, it's quite easy for folks to kind of say, well, here's an example, so we're going to assume this happens with all bacteria, all drug combinations, and that is an erroneous assumption and one that quickly gets us into problems when we start making broad policy decisions based off of a very limited number of specific examples. And so I would wholeheartedly echo Dr. Fate's comments that, you know, really resistance has to be considered as a specific bacterial species, drug, environment, host combination. And so there you've got four variables for which, you know, you could have an almost endless number of possible combinations and pulling out one or two examples where we know there's a problem and then assuming that it happens for all the other multitude of those very quickly takes us down a path of perhaps making poor choices or choices that impact on an animal health or animal welfare just as a precaution.
Fair enough. Well, I think this is a rabbit hole that we could dive way down into and could inspire someone to pursue a PhD in microbiology someday if they were interested. But let's kind of step back for a minute and talk about who is at the most risk for transmission of resistant bacteria, since we're talking about this in terms of dairy goats and veterinary health. Is it the consumer who's buying goat milk at the store if it has resistant bacteria in it? Or is it the people on the farm that are handling the animals every day? Where does the highest risk fall?
Well, I think that's a great question, and as Virginia pointed out earlier, I don't know there's simple answers to any of these questions. I can give specific examples. Raw milk likely poses a much higher risk. Raw milk cheeses or raw milk in general poses a higher risk of exposure to antimicrobial resistant pathogens because pasteurization has not been performed to remove those pathogens from those products. So consumers, whether that's a producer or a lay public consumer of raw milk or raw milk cheeses, certainly would be an area where there could be potential risk for transmission of resistant Campylobacter, for instance, or resistant to some other specific milk pathogens. An example of where a producer could be at higher risk, and this is also going to be a Campylobacter one, but in abortion storms. So if you're having an abortion storm on your farm, many of those abortion agents have zoonotic risk and can cause disease in the producers if there's a high enough exposure level and, you know, you're not using good hand hygiene or contaminating through that process. And there again, some examples like Campylobacter perhaps could cause disease. So really the simplest answer is exposure to either the animals that are shedding in high numbers or milk that's not pasteurized would be the highest risk individuals for that potential transmission.
Yeah, and I think that the unknown amount of risk is if those antibiotic-resistant bacteria, like Dr. Plummer just talked about, or others that may have acquired resistance in some other way, if those are shed into the environment, for example, they're in the feces and then they're shed into the environment, and then whatever, however that environmental contamination is managed, the theoretical possibility of those elements of resistance being transmitted and becoming a general public health risk are really unknown. So we think, well, it's a small farm, I'm a small dairy, I live in rural Iowa or rural Texas or whatever, it can't be that big a risk. And the fact is, I don't know that there's very good data to actually quantify what that risk is. It's a theoretical risk. It's something we should be considering. It's one of the reasons that there's, you know, discussions about how to manage large operations that have large, for example, lagoons for managing waste, and what are the environmental regulations related to that. But those are all theoretical risks. There's a lot of conversation about it. I've seen recent studies about, you know, pharmaceuticals or antibiotic resistance genes in waterways of all kinds, surface water and other things. And identifying them is useful information. But just because they're there doesn't mean they're either high risk or low risk. We don't really know. And so I think there's a lot we don't know about. Who else, aside from the individuals who are directly managing animals who have been either treated with antibiotics or have exhibited bacteria that have antibiotic resistance, outside of those, I don't know that we know what the risk is. And that's not to be scary, like, oh my God, there's a big risk. I just think we don't, it's not quantified very well. And it's certainly possible that it's a very, very low risk. That would be my assumption. But it's also possible that it's higher than we think it is. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of unknowns about that, about who is really at the most risk, particularly if you're talking about a very specific commodity, right? If you're talking about goat milk, what's the risk of goats transmitting antimicrobial resistance to people? You know, you start talking about cattle feedlots, much larger populations of animals, much larger waste stream, you know, et cetera. But we still, I think it's still unquantified in a lot of ways how much risk that is to the general public.
So that's certainly not to say that consuming raw milk cheeses is going to give you resistant bacteria, but that does kind of bring me to my next question. Dr. Fate and I spoke recently about avoiding antibiotic residues in meat and milk. And so I think it's important to differentiate how are antibiotic residues different from antimicrobial resistance.
Yeah, sure. That's a really important point, and it certainly can be confusing when we talk about antibiotics, about residues versus resistance. And as we talked about in that podcast, anytime you use a drug in an animal or a person, there's a period of time where that drug is in the animal, and then it is eliminated at some fairly well-known rate. And studies are performed in drugs that are approved for use in food-producing animals to determine how long food products should be withheld so that they have levels of drug that are below a risk. And that's called a tolerance. We want the level of drug to be below the tolerance, and the tolerance is determined based on a bunch of different pieces of information, scientifically derived information about what is acceptable risk, essentially. And so when we talk about residues, that includes all drugs. That's not just antibiotics. We're trying to prevent the food supply from being contaminated with concentrations of drug that might cause problems in humans. And antibiotics are the same as all the other drugs that that we potentially use in food-producing animals or any animals. And so that's what a residue is. There is a little bit of crossover, and that may be why there's some sort of mixing up of the two, in that if an antibiotic residue were to exist in, for example, milk that is then being fed to young animals who are now being exposed to low levels of antibiotic, that then would select for resistance in those offspring. Also a very, you know, theoretical pathway, although there are a few studies about feeding waste milk with antibiotic residues in it to calves and selection for antibiotic-resistant bacteria, at least in the gut. And so that's where there's a crossover between residues and resistance. But they definitely are, it's definitely important that they be separated from each other. And one doesn't cause the other. They exist independently.
I think Dr. Fate did a good job describing that. We just find through our efforts here at NIAMRI that particularly out in the public, there's a lot of confusion on those issues. And, you know, folks equate that any time an antibiotic's going to be given, that now I'm going to have resistance. And it's no, there will be a residue. But our food system is actually very good at preventing those residues, and we have exceedingly low rates of of contamination of food with antibiotics. So consumers don't need to be broadly concerned as it relates to risk. The risk of exposure of consuming an antibiotic in food that comes through our food safety inspection service is exceedingly low. We know that. But every antibiotic use does not select for resistance, and testing for antibiotics in the milk will also, or in the meat, will also not eliminate the resistance if it's there. So there's just quite a bit of confusion around that, and I think it is good to highlight because there seems to be this assumption that every time we give an antibiotic, then resistance is there, and that is by no means the case. If that were the case, we never have success treating diseases, because once we used an antibiotic once, then everything would be resistant.
That's a great way to think about it. It's not an easy thing to do, to make a bacteria change its DNA to be resistant to an antimicrobial, generally speaking. These are metabolically expensive processes for the bacteria. Otherwise, they would be made resistant to begin with. Like, some bacteria don't respond to certain antibiotics naturally, but it's not just something that happens with one use. So it sounds like you're saying we don't need to just stop using antibiotics altogether.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think there, if we were to say you can't use antibiotics anymore in animals, or you can't use them anymore in food producing animals, the animal welfare risks, and in fact, potentially even risks to public health from animals that weren't effectively treated for some infection that then ended up in the food supply, could actually end up with bacterial infections causing problems that way. And so, but strictly from a, you know, from the veterinarian perspective of, should we just let animals die from bacterial infections or suffer from bacterial infections? That doesn't seem to me to be the best answer. And it wouldn't necessarily solve all of our problems about antimicrobial resistance. There still will be resistance. There are naturally occurring resistance genes that have been uncovered from the permafrost. And so antibiotic resistance genes have been around since bacteria have been around. That's how they compete for resources in their own little ecological niches. And so that's not the answer to eliminate all antimicrobial use. I'm sure Dr. Plummer has some words to say about that as well, because I do think it's an easy out if you don't understand how animals are raised, how animal production works, what veterinary medicine is all about, what our obligations are, the oaths that we take, right, as veterinarians to protect animal health, that those would all be challenged by just saying, you know, carte blanche, remove all antimicrobials from use in animals. Paul?
Completely agree. And as you pointed out, I mean, even removing all antimicrobials from use, we could stop giving all antimicrobials to humans, animals, and you know, stop manufacturing antimicrobials, and resistance is going to continue to develop because these organisms, penicillin is produced, you know, we now manufacture that, but was originally produced, and many of these antibiotics are produced by the organisms themselves, as Dr. Fate pointed out. The possibility of stopping complete antimicrobial use, you know, obviously impacts a significant detriment on our ability to keep animals healthy, and as well as assure good animal welfare. We also do have some data, risk modeling, for instance. So Dr. Bing Wong's group at University of Nebraska-Lincoln has looked at risk modeling. This is in beef, and looked at the potential decrease in risk associated with stopping using antibiotics entirely, and compared that to the potential decrease in risk for following good food safety hygiene practices with cooking of that meat, and demonstrated that the complete removal of antibiotics resulted in less than a 2 or 3% impact on risk to the end consumer, whereas good meat handling hygiene and cooking to an appropriate internal temperature reduced that risk by 99%. So here again, you know, we can have much higher impacts in terms of food safety risk with good handling and good food hygiene and cooking to an appropriate temperature. Removing antibiotics from that mix does not impact that risk nearly to the degree that good handling does.
Those are fantastic points that you both bring up. And Dr. Plummer, you also touched on something. Penicillin is a naturally occurring antimicrobial, and there are plenty of natural supplements out there that have antimicrobial properties that can impact antimicrobial resistance. It's not just manufactured drugs that can cause resistance. And the nice thing about drugs is that go through this, you know, FDA approval process and that whole system is that we have a very good understanding of how those work and the impacts that they have on the bacteria that they're affecting. However, with, you know, other supplements, natural remedies, things like that, that don't go through the same rigorous process, we have a very incomplete understanding of the role that they play in the body and how, you know, what systems they affect and how they affect them. So, in my mind anyway, all of those unknowns, pose more potential for risk.
You're certainly right. And we do see that So for instance, sometimes the way these resistance mechanisms are carried, there's other environmental resistances. So metals, metal concentrations can impact, the selection and emergence for resistance, copper in the environment, copper in feeds, other metals as well. And interestingly, towards your point on supplements and stuff, there's a growing body of evidence that some of our probiotics and those types of supplements actually have the potential to carry resistance in them. So because there's not screening process for many of those probiotic over-the-counter generally recognized as safe type of products, we do know now that in some cases there's actually resistance in those probiotic organisms. I don't think that's been associated with any sort of increased disease risk in animals or humans, and so what risk that really poses, I don't know, but purely on the potential, resistant organisms can be moved through even those supplements, as you were discussing.
Wow, I had not even seen that data out yet. So that's really interesting, Dr. Plummer. Dr. Fate, you mentioned that we have an obligation for judicious use and appropriate use in maintaining animal health and welfare, and balancing that with the risks that we've been discussing today. When I was practicing in California, any antibiotic required a veterinary prescription. However, that's not currently the case in most of the other 49 states in the U.S. I understand that rule will be changing in the future, though. So what does this mean for producers and veterinarians in the rest of the country?
I'm glad you brought that up, Michelle, because it is something that's going to change soon. There are still some antibiotics that are available over the counter, so you can go to a Tractor Supply or feed store, or other places like that, and purchase. Particularly, most of them are available for livestock. Historically, were available for producers to purchase on their own without a veterinary order, without a prescription. And all of those products throughout the United States are going to be all required to become prescription products. And prescription means a veterinarian will have to write an order, a prescription, for producers to use those drugs or to purchase those drugs. And so that's going to be a big change. In some parts of the country, it won't make a lot of difference because there's availability of pharmacies and drug distribution centers and so on. Other parts of the country, where there are fewer veterinarians or veterinary access is problematic, there may be some challenges. And so now is the time for producers to be thinking about, who is my veterinarian? Who do I call for advice? And can I, if I don't have a veterinarian that I regularly call, I need to find someone to establish the veterinary client-patient relationship, that VCPR, so that when I am faced with a problem, I have someone to call and someone who's familiar with me and my operation that will be willing to help with writing prescriptions, seeing animals, diagnosing disease, and so on. So it's a really good, this is an opportunity to talk about it. The FDA is planning various kinds of educational efforts. I'm sure NIAMRI is as well, but it is going to be a big change. There was a big change a few years ago when all of the antibiotic feed additives became VFD drugs, veterinary feed directive drugs, and required veterinary oversight. But this is kind of the next step of providing additional care with making decisions about antimicrobials and having veterinarians who are trained in animal health and drug therapy and making decisions about drugs and have the license to do so, being involved in making decisions about antimicrobial use in all animals.
For producers that may be listening, things you might be using that would be impacted here would be over-the-counter penicillins, tetracyclines, oxytetracyclines, Tylosin, some of the macrolides that right now you could go purchase. As of next summer of 2023, you won't be able to go purchase those, as Dr. Fate said. So I too would echo the encouragement to find a veterinarian if you don't have one. And since we're on the AASRP podcast, the AASRP website also has an option for find a small ruminant veterinarian in your area. So would encourage producers that might be looking for a small ruminant vet in your area to go to the website, AASRP.org, and look for a local veterinarian to establish a relationship with, so that you'll continue to be able to assure your animal's health with the use of these drugs when necessary after they become not available over the counter.
And I would just add that the point of this legislation coming through is not to make it so that now producers can just pick up the phone and say, hey, doc, whoever, you know, is my local vet in town, I have a goat that has pneumonia and I need to give him a shot of whatever antibiotic. Can I come pick it up? There will be requirements for maintaining a regular relationship with your veterinarian where they see your animals at least once a year, and help you to develop an animal health plan. This is not just a hands-off type of scenario. And per our discussion today and in previous episodes, it really shouldn't be, because we all need to be involved in making these decisions appropriately. So I would also encourage potentially companion animal veterinarians or vets who work on species other than small ruminants to utilize the resources that we're providing in this podcast and contact myself or any of the guests that we've had on the show with questions to help you feel more confident in dealing with small ruminant species, because we do have an issue with getting access to care for a lot of our producers. And it can be a little bit scary to start working on a species that you're not used to, but as a community, we're here to help. And so any questions that practitioners have can be emailed to dairygoatextension@iastate.edu. And we want to be a resource to give people the confidence to help serve our small ruminant clients and make sure that we're helping them take the best care of their animals. So a little plug for that as well. I want to kind of shift gears a little bit now. We kind of mentioned this earlier, but let's talk about how we are tracking antimicrobial resistance in food-producing animals. I know both of you have stated that this is an area where we're lacking a lot of data, but where and how are we starting to collect this data?
Sure. You're exactly right that we do not have any kind of systematic national efforts to bring that data together. I would say that certainly within some production systems and within a number of veterinary clinics, there probably is a reasonable understanding of what resistance occurs in those animals that they treat regularly. So if I'm a veterinarian in a large dairy goat production system and I have significant resistance to an organism that causes disease in those animals, I'm likely to figure that out through diagnostics, but also because of treatment failures. And so I would say that it's not that we have a complete lack of knowledge. It's just bringing that knowledge together on a larger scale, even at a veterinary, pulling all of that data together in a veterinary clinic or at a state or at a national level. There is interest and pressure, certainly at both the national and the international level, to start to build those databases. Some countries around the world have very extensive national databases in which they're able to collect that data. And largely that's most effective in countries where there's kind of a much more centralized veterinary care system for the veterinary data, so that you've only got one or two sources where all that data is coming into, and so really pulling it together is it's almost a you know, a misnomer because it was all together to begin with, which is certainly not the case here in the U.S., where we have so many different veterinarians and production systems. So there also is a complexity here that, you know, going back to that concept that Dr. Fate mentioned earlier of complexity, you know, there is a lot of risk of comparing apples to oranges when you start pulling these things together from different sources. So there's multiple ways to measure resistance. There's multiple ways to identify the resistance. There's multiple, if you will, definitions or, you know, without getting into too much detail there, determining what exact level of resistance constitutes a resistant organism. So these aren't kind of black and white concepts. And so as you start to pull this data together, you have to be very careful that you don't start making erroneous comparisons and erroneous assumptions when actually it's a difference in data collection or data reporting. So I think I'll end with that and see if Dr. Fate has comments.
Yeah, one of the things I was thinking about is the source of the bacteria in which you are measuring the resistance. And so if you have a relatively passive surveillance system and you collect the bacterial isolates from, for example, diagnostic laboratories, those samples are already biased because typically they come from animals that have already been treated with an antibiotic, and that's the reason that a sample was sent in the first place. And so gathering example isolates of bacteria from animals that have not yet been treated for the disease they have, in order to accurately characterize resistance in a particular bacterial pathogen, is a big challenge and certainly isn't routinely done. That's not how veterinarians, that's not how physicians make decisions about. They don't isolate a bacteria from every single individual that gets treated before they treat. And in order to characterize resistance appropriately, that's almost what you would have to do, right? And so we have to be completely accurate. So we depend on other ways of acquiring those bacteria, and some of those ways can lead to biases in terms of assessing the true proportion of bacteria that are resistant. And there are diagnostic labs that use different systems, and it's challenging to compare not just across drug groups and individual drugs within groups, but the same bacteria from different species of animals. And what does that mean? And how do we? And so I think the collecting of the data and analyzing it is challenging, and the interpretation is could easily go awry. And so having lots of discussions about the best way to approach those things to surveil for antibiotic resistance. And not that it's not happening, because it certainly is. And we need to continue to be cautious about how we're interpreting those data, and that we're making appropriate policy decisions based on data that are not, that may or may not be truly accurate or an accurate representation of the prevalence of resistance.
That makes a lot of sense. And it also kind of makes me a little bit nervous, because my primary PhD project has a portion of it that's evaluating development of antimicrobial resistance in dairy goats specifically. But Dr. Plummer, you've put me at ease a little bit because Dr. Fate, because essentially what we're doing is taking samples, cultures, bacterial cultures of goats before they're dried off. And based on those results, we'll be treating those that are positive for certain bacteria with two different antimicrobials. So each goat will get one of those two, or be assigned one of those two groups. And then after they kid, we'll be going back out collecting another sample. And so any of our goats that don't clear their infection, we'll be genotyping them, so looking at their DNA to determine if they have a resistance gene and if that could be the reason that they didn't clear the infection. And so we're looking at the overall prevalence of infection at dry off. We're looking at cure rates and how effective these antimicrobial treatments are. And then we're also looking at the prevalence of antimicrobial resistance when it's applied on a targeted dry off treatment. And this isn't addressing any kind of blanket treatment like some dairies might treat every animal at dry off. So this isn't quite that scale, but just making sure that we're targeting bacteria that we believe to be susceptible to the antibiotics that we're evaluating. So, but I'm nervous in that I know that these are very scenario specific. Resistance can be very scenario specific. So something that holds true for my study here in Iowa could be not applicable to a dairy farm in another part of the country. We are also running a portion of this trial in California to see how this compares, but definitely recognize that there's a lot more data to be collected, and we could run this study on a different dairy in every state, and I imagine we could get a little bit different result. So, but we're excited to see what the result is and hopefully inspire more research along these lines later on. So we'll keep you posted on that.
And I would just add that, you in those comments, you're pointing to the resistance prevalence, which certainly is part of that research outcome, and that could vary from farm to farm. But you're also evaluating the targeted antibiotic treatment, right? So selection, instead of doing blanket treatment, selection of specific animals to treat based on culture approaches. And those types of outcomes, to the extent that they reduced antibiotic use, many of those animals that if we do blanket treatment may not have ever needed treatment. They may not have had an infection, but we're still using that antibiotic. Those types of outcomes still may have a much higher external validity, regardless of the exact prevalence of resistance within the farm. So the impact of being able to reduce antimicrobial use through selective dry dough therapy also has an external validity that's probably higher than an individual farm prevalence.
I just want to say it sounds like a really cool project, Michelle, and that's exactly the kind of work that we need to continue to do to assess the real risk of resistance itself, of selecting for resistance, what that looks like over time in animals. And so I'm excited that this work is happening.
Thank you. It's been fun in a kind of nerdy way so far. But it's time for us to wrap up for the day. So if you could both just give us a little recap and summary on how veterinarians and producers can help to mitigate antimicrobial resistance development, especially as it pertains to dairy goat production.
Yeah, sure. I'll start off. And so, I think as we think about this for the practitioners out there, the veterinary practitioners, but also as the producers, our goal is to use antibiotics when we need them to assure animal health and animal welfare, but to make decisions and make management decisions and as well as kind of treatment decisions that help us to assure that we or make our best effort to not use antibiotics when they're not going to be necessary or helpful. So as a producer and a veterinarian, things I think through in that process are, number one, how can I prevent disease in my animals? So whether that's vaccination, whether that's biosecurity, and making sure I'm not introducing diseased animals into the herd or flock, whether that is routine surveillance, perhaps for, on dairies, some intermittent milk cultures, but mitigating disease risk through vaccination and biosecurity helps to ultimately reduce the amount of antimicrobials that we have to use and the potential risk for antimicrobial emergence. Then the decision around treatment decisions, or the process of treatment decisions. And this is why the FDA is moving us towards having veterinary involvement, evaluating each animal and making an appropriate disease treatment decision for that animal. Does this animal need antibiotics or not? Certainly, for instance, let's think about kids, dairy goat kids with diarrhea. There are some bacterial causes to that diarrhea. Even in those bacterial causes, antibiotics are not always necessary, but there's also plenty of non-bacterial reasons for diarrhea for which antibiotics are not going to have any impact. And so just saying that every goat kid with diarrhea needs antibiotics is probably not where we need to be at, and we need to be moving towards more selective treatment process. And so working with their veterinarian to make that decision. And then finally, almost every talk I give on this, whether I'm talking to prescribers like veterinarians or producers, you know, my view of this across the One Health spectrum, in my role, I work with human physicians giving antibiotics, veterinarians, dentists, nurse practitioners, environmental. We use antibiotics in plants and crops. And, you know, my take home message is if we all make the commitment to try and use antibiotics better tomorrow than we did today, that's the forward progress that we need to make. It's each of us making the individual decisions on a daily basis that improves how we use those antibiotics. So those would be my take homes, and I'm sure Dr. Fate has some great ones to add.
I'll just follow up by saying the resources, particularly for veterinarians and producers. Well, there's certainly, I mean, I could list lots and lots of different things, but I think really good places to start are the AVMA, American Veterinary Medical Association website. There's a section on antibiotics and antibiotic resistance, and there's links to other resources. There's really useful guidelines for veterinarians about all the things that Dr. Plummer was just talking about. And also similar kinds of resources from the AASRP website. So specific to small ruminant practitioners, how do I think about using drugs, antibiotics in a prudent manner? And what makes me an antimicrobial steward? How can I make the best decisions? And AASRP has continuing education sessions, and often they're related to making treatment decisions, some of which involve antibiotics. And so and preventing disease and so on. So those two are really good resources for the veterinarian and for the producer to share with their veterinarian to get you started, to kind of give the high level view of what is it that makes antimicrobial stewardship better from the veterinarian perspective.
Fantastic. And we'll put some links to a few of those pages in our show notes as well. And of course, folks can always email, again, dairygoatextension@iastate.edu with specific questions. Or if you're not sure if a resource is valid, feel free to send it our way, and we can help steer you as well. So that about wraps it up for today. Thank you both so much. This has been a really enlightening discussion. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. And I hope we get to have you both back on soon. Have a great day.